From JetBooks, this is Irish Business Builders, a show about great Irish businesses and the people who built them. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping.
Our goal was any units that were underperforming or even loss-making was to throw all the resources we had in the business at those units to turn them around and get them into a profitable making. You don't worry so much about the units making money as you do about the units not making money.
I'm Connor Carney, and that's the voice of Brian Hogan, owner and former CEO of Kylemore Services Group, a restaurant and hospitality business operating in over 100 locations nationwide in both retail and commercial catering. Brian's grandparents opened the very first Kylemore Bakery in Dublin in 1920, which eventually became the largest fresh bakery in Ireland under Brian's management. In this conversation, Brian talks about starting out in the family business at age 17, learning from their very best multinational suppliers, and why partnering with DCC was the best deal he's ever done in his life. I started out by asking Brian to walk me through the business of KSG.
Well, KSG stands for Kylemore Services Group, formerly Kylemore, formerly Kylemore Bakery, and formerly Kilmore, if you go back nearly 100 years. So it's now a service company. We do contract catering for hospitality in work environment, major offices, transport hubs, airports and train stations, healthcare. We do hospitals, and also we have a pharma practice, and then professional offices, which would be services to the likes of the big five accountancy firms, the big five law firms. So they're our basic division. And then we have a small retail division as well, which is kind of a legacy business from the old Cafe Kylemore days. We have three of those at the moment.
What percentage would the retail business be of the overall business?
Oh, it's less than 10% now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And you started in the contract catering business. Was it only about 10 years ago at this stage?
2004.
Okay.
We had just come off the back of opening a string of Cafe Kylemore restaurants from 1987 right up to 2001. We opened 15 restaurants in Dublin, Newry, Derry, Galway, Cork, Waterford, and then the rest in Dublin. It was a good business. Started in 84. In the first unit was in Ratmyne Shopping Centre, and then we opened the big one on O'Connell Street in 87. And it was a very good business for a number of years. In the beginning of the boom, the Celtic Tiger boom, late 90s, early 2000s, rents just went crazy. And at the same time, the amount of competition in the shopping centres and on the high street grew exponentially. You had all the likes of all the fast food chains, the coffee shops, etc. So we had rising rents and lowering turnover. So the restaurant business went from being a very strong business to being a very average business, which probably is the norm in the life cycle of any business. We had from 87 to 2004, we had really good years. With the rents the way they were going, we just decided we weren't going to sign any more leases and take on any more rents. And we said, well, we got this skill set of people and product and purchasing and quality control and hygiene and all of the various boxes. What can we do with it? So we had a look at the contract catering business, and we just thought, why can't we do that? It seems to be, we can do it in a high street, we can do it in a network environment or in an airport or wherever else. So that was really the focus. We stopped opening restaurants, and then we said, what can we do now? And that was how we got into the contract catering business.
How did you start to change the business model? Was it very slowly with a couple of customers at first, or did you kind of go in at scale with a number of customers and huge marketing budgets and things like that? How did that initial kind of few years start?
It initially just started off the back of the restaurant business, and we got one or two contracts, and we learned the business from there. We made a lot of mistakes in the beginning. We took contracts that were too small, too troublesome. We had in Cafe Kylemore, we had 15 restaurants with one menu, one price point, one product, you know, one system, one SOP. So you could just roll them out like a chain restaurant. Suddenly then you were dealing with clients and client businesses, and every one of those is different. price was necessarily, might have been an item in some of the more price-conscious contracts. And in other contracts, people wanted best of the best of the best. So you had to vary every single unit to the client's wishes. And that was very difficult for us at the beginning because we weren't used to that skill set.
How did you get involved in the business originally?
Oh, long story, long time ago. I was always very keen. I'm fourth generation. My great-grandfather had a dairy shop in Talbot Street called Kilmore Dairies. And he came from a farming family in Offaly. And they used to bring up cream and buttercream and buttermilk from Offaly on the train and bring it down to them. And then we distribute the cream around all the various hotels and units around Dublin. So my father and all the family were born over that shop in 73 Talbot Street. So there was four kids. And my grandmother, who I love to have met, sadly, she died before I was born, who I think was a great entrepreneur. She started making cakes in the shop on a Sunday of an All-Ireland hurling final. She started making cakes and putting them in the window of the shop because the shop was closed. So she made a load of cakes in the basement. That was the beginning of what was then Kylemore Bakery.
What happened directly after Kylemore Bakery started? And was it just that one unit for a short amount?
Yeah, I don't know much about that. Would have been around 1920, the year my father was born. So I came into the business in 1970. So during that time, I think she grew it to six or seven shops in the Great Depression of the 20s and the 30s. And sadly, she died in the 40s. Then my father, who was a doctor, he took over the business, but really hadn't, his heart wasn't in it. He was a surgeon and he loved medicine. So, but as a kid, I used to go into the business every holiday I could, Christmas or Easter or summer. And I'd pack hot cross buns, mince pies, Christmas cakes, plum puddings, drive vans, wash down, anything I could basically do that kept me out of school. I was very happy to do. I wasn't too academic in school. So I just loved being around the business. And I knew from a very early age, that's what I wanted to do. And then my prayers were sort of answered, if you like, in that the week after I'd finished my leaving cert, the banks put the business into receivership. And we had a major problem with the business. It had grown quite a lot at that stage. I think they were up to 12 or 13 shops. But there was no system in the business. There was nobody running the business. It was very loose. So I literally started work that week. My first meeting was with the bank manager to see could we talk him into doing something. So the bank gave us 6 weeks, got stuck into the business, age 17. What we found was the business was a really good business, but there was absolutely no controls anywhere in the business. There was stock walking out. There was cash walking out. There were clock cards, you know, for people who didn't show up. It was just so incredibly loose, the business. So as soon as we tidied that up, and it was very easy to do, you learn very fast and very hard a situation like that. Within 3 months, the business had turned around and was making money. And so the pressure was off. And that was my start in the business.
As a 17-year-old starting off in a business, I know you said it was easy, you know, to change the systems and to improve everything and to put the systems in place. Did you understand the business fundamentally at that stage, or did you have a kind of a guiding light in the form of a mentor or maybe someone who was ahead of you in the business at that stage?
Absolutely didn't understand the business, just understood the need to get this thing sorted out. It was pretty straight up. Most of it was just fear. So that's a very good motivator at times if you think you're going to lose the family home and the business and everything else. So a lot of the incentive was fear, coupled with some really great people in the business who had been there for years and years and years, who had been kind of passed over by some of the more loose people in the business. And when you made those changes and then got the really great people involved in the business, and moved on the people who were really causing the problem, which we had to do very quickly. That was really what it was all about, was bringing out the best and the best people. And unfortunately, having to move out a lot of the people who were causing the problem. Not that many, but it was just, and the sense of no system made everybody in the place casual. And then immediately they saw a sense and a purpose and somebody who was doing something and doing something about the problems. The good people just rose up like you wouldn't believe. Like in a matter of weeks, I was getting knocks on the door, people saying, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? You know, why don't you sort that problem out? Because they were all looking at their own jobs as well. And jobs weren't very plentiful in 1970 in Dublin. So it was an extraordinary time when you learned how great people can be when they're given the incentive and the motivation and the space.
That must have been a huge learning curve for you as a 17-year-old who had just started in the business to be given a role that was quite high up at that stage.
It was. I was completely unaware of it, to be honest. I didn't know what my role was or what I was doing or what the purpose was. The only purpose was to try and get this thing back on the tracks. And I suppose being the son of the owner, you automatically assume the senior role and the people on the floor give you that. You know, I didn't have to earn my stripes, as it were. They were given to me. But I was fortunate that we probably had to deal with all those problems early on. And I earned that respect. I hope I earned that respect at a reasonably early age.
Were you a confident kid, or do you think working in the business would have helped you along in that sense?
Yeah, I was always competitive. I mean, I wasn't great in school, but I was good in sports and good in anything competitive. So it did bring out that competitive nature in me to make a go of this thing. Confident, I'd say I was average. I wouldn't think I was overconfident, but I certainly wasn't shy. But again, a lot of it is just necessity. You know, you do things when your back is to the wall that you wouldn't necessarily do had you come through the normal school, college, apprenticeship and junior role in the business.
At that stage, did you have a plan for where you wanted to go with the business? Obviously, improving it was the immediate issue. But for yourself and your own career, did you have a plan or maybe a vision of what you thought you might become in future years?
No, not at 17, 18. No, I mean, you just, I was so delighted that we turned it around. I was so delighted to be in there. I absolutely loved the business from a very early age. I loved the people in the business. So it was kind of a journey that was born out of eventually necessity. But I always knew I'd wanted to be in the business from a very young age. And I didn't really want to do anything else. I never looked at other career options. I didn't go to, you know, other mentors or other people to ask questions. I might have had to have the space and the time to do it, but I didn't. So I just discovered, I found myself, I think, in the business that I probably wasn't that confident early on, but I found my own confidence grew as the business grew.
You had been in for a couple of years, I suppose, at that stage. How did you end up owning the business?
So that was the start in 1970. And then, so my father went back to medicine and left me alone in the business. And in fairness to him, it was a great opportunity because most father-son relationships are difficult because the father is the owner and mentor of the business. And they sit on the son's desk, if you like, watching everything they're doing. I had the opposite situation. My father just wanted to get back to medicine. And once we turned it around, he was absolutely delighted that everything went good. So he was clever guy. He was very decisive, very clear in his thinking. And if I'd go to him with ideas or what I wanted to do, I don't think he ever turned anything down that I wanted to do. And if I made a mistake, he'd just say, well, that's fine. You know, don't make it again and get on with it. He was very clear, like a lot of good surgeons, I think. They're very clinical about their decisions. So in the 70s to 80s, we opened more shops. We started to look at America for ideas. The whole in-store bakery business in America was growing fast. And we started to go over to the annual Retail Bakers of America conference every year and just watch the trends and watch the start, as did Fergal Quinn, who introduced the first supermarket bakery in Super Quinn in the late 70s in Dublin. And the big thing then was frozen dough. We used to make the dough, freeze it, send it out to supermarkets, then chill it, prove it, and bake it on the site. So it was the beginning of the sort of the in-store bakery market where supermarkets wanted freshly cooked bread on the site. And we then built a frozen dough. At the end of the 70s, we built a frozen dough plant, and we opened supermarket sites and started, as long as our own shops, as well as our own shops, we started developing into the supermarket trade. That took us up to 1980-ish. We had, at that stage, we had about 30 units in supermarkets, and we had about 15 shops. So the business was growing nicely over that time. And then in 81, Marks and Spencer's approached us when they opened their shop in Henry Street, or Mary Street. And they said they wanted a fresh bakery supplier, but they wouldn't deal with anybody unless they could come up to Marks and Spencer's standards. It was one store, so none of the big bakers wanted to know about it because the volume was, I think it was £1,000 a week or something. But I was very keen to do it because I knew Marks and Spencer's standards and the name of being a Marks and Spencer supplier in 1981 would be huge with other customers. So we went with them. They came in, audited the bakery. We had to do a huge amount of work to bring it up to the high standards that they had. But it was, everybody benefited from that. You know, we all benefited. So that was a great learning curve. You know, we got more out of Marks and Spencer's than they got out of us just by sheer learning how to be professional, how to raise your hygiene standards, how to raise your delivery. Everything they did was really good. And they did a very interesting relationship with their bakery guy over there. They had some wonderful ideas. And one of them was, I always remember you had an annual visit from a director of the company, which oddly, you know, we were doing £1,000 a week with Marks and Spencer's, but we got a visit from a board director once a year. And we'd go and have dinner. And just, again, talking to those guys, learning from them was fantastic. And one of the things I always remember was, the rule was you were not allowed, the supplier was not allowed pay. Didn't matter what you were doing. So Marks and Spencer's would take you to dinner and would have dinner with you and talk you through the business. You'd learn so much from that. That was brilliant. So again, that helped our supermarket business. We refined that model better and better. We got it up to about 100 supermarkets through the 80s. I think we were up to about 30 shops at that stage. So the business grew. And then McDonald's approached us and wanted us to supply for the Irish market, their hamburger buns. Again, another fantastic company to work with. Their standards were just second to none. We had to build a whole new plant to supply them. But working with them was just fantastic. And again, the ethos of that company was amazing. One of the things I always remember was when you traveled on McDonald's business, they never left you alone in the hotel room. So if I'd go to Germany or Amsterdam or America to see a plant or to a McDonald's conference, you'd arrive at the room and there'd be a letter to say, John will pick you up at 8 o'clock. Now, John could have been the office junior, or he could have been the marketing guy, or he could have been the chief executive of that particular territory. It didn't matter. But they never left you on your own in the hotel room. And what happened then was you ended up going home to that guy's home or to a restaurant. If he was babysitting that night, you might have been just watching, had beers and pizza, watching football or whatever. But inevitably, you were working because you were talking about the business. They were talking about the business. So the education from that across the whole world was extraordinary. It was just a wonderful culture and something that they, as a company, promoted right through all their people. They never left anybody in a hotel room on their own at nighttime, which I thought was brilliant.
Was there ever any stage throughout this whole period, you know, you were getting slightly larger customers, maybe more high profile customers, certainly with M&S and McDonald's. Was there a time to reflect at this stage to say, God, this business is doing pretty well, and, you know, maybe we could even grow it further? What was on your mind during these years?
Just drive. There wasn't a plan, to be honest. It was just driving as hard as we could. You know, we knew we had a good business. We knew we had great people. Good product, and we just wanted to learn and learn and learn. So the opportunity to work with McDonald's and Marks and Spencer's, who were global food retailers at that stage, was just absolutely fantastic. And just that, you know, all boats rise on a rising tide, and we certainly did. We grew a lot of confidence out of those companies and working with them. Weren't easy. I mean, you know, that we weren't making a whole lot of money on them, but the learning curve was huge.
Mm. And what was your role specifically in the business at that stage?
I was chief executive from about 1970, managing director as it was then, from about 1978. I sort of formally took on the role. I'd already been doing the job, but I never actually had bothered with sort of formalizing the role. And then maybe I got a bit older and a bit wiser and said, no, I want to be the managing director. So that was 77 or 78, just after I got married.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. as you were managing director, you were already doing the role. Did you find it hard to kind of learn that role? I know some people, they kind of work their way up in a business and they might find it hard to let go of a particular area, or maybe they're getting too involved without delegating enough. How did you evolve within that role of the managing director?
I think badly, probably. I was kind of that dreadful owner-driver, have to do everything yourself. I wasn't a good delegator. I was great at Teams meetings and great at sort of, you know, meeting up at everybody. But I think I got to a stage where nobody could do anything unless I sort of was involved, which was, you know, I just had no idea how to manage. Absolutely none whatsoever. And again, I think probably the starting out with a degree in fear, then you still have that fear going through that you have to be involved in everything. So we looked at Bewley's. Bewley's went into receivership in 1985, 86, and we probably tried very hard to buy it at that time, but I didn't have the experience. I didn't really know what I was doing, and we didn't buy it in the end. And then we decided to go, having looked at Bewley's, we decided to go our own route in the cafe business. And we opened in 1987, we opened the O'Connell's route. We had already opened one in Rathmines Shopping Centre in 84, so we were looking at it anyway. But that the failure of Bewley's at the time just encouraged us to look further into the restaurant business. So then Colmore Bakery started Cafe Colmore, and that was in August of 1987. We opened on O'Connell Street. And that became a very, very instant success, followed by Cork in 88, Newry in 89, Cork, Waterford, Galway. We kept rolling out restaurants, and a couple in Dublin as well. St. Stephen's Green Centre in 89 also was a big one. So suddenly we grew a substantial restaurant business off the back of the bakery business. And that was tremendous for us to be able to try something completely new out of the bakery sector completely and make a success of it. And that was great.
What about financing at that point? Were you financing all these new locations from prior revenues, or did you get kind of outside sources?
Up to there, we did it all from cash flow and borrowing. And the cash flow of the restaurant business was actually, you know, I suppose from both businesses, the cash flow was strong because you make today and sell today and you pay in 60 days or whatever. So all of your outgoings are 60 days down the line. So it gave us very strong cash flow to do that. Now, at the time, I had no idea what cash flow was. I just look in the bank and go, yeah, we got enough money to do it. So I just went and did it. Wasn't until I teamed up with DCC that I learned about cash flow. Mm. But at the end of that decade, then I went to my father and said, now, you know, I need to start doing some stuff for myself. So he sat down and over a two-year period and a fairly serious negotiation and some disappointment and argument, as there always is in a family business, I eventually ended up buying 80% of the business in 1989. And that was AIB were absolutely fantastic at that stage. They backed everything 100% and really believed in the business, really believed in what we had done. It allowed me to pay my father a substantial amount of money for buying out the 80% share. So that was great. Then on the 1st of January in 1990, I found myself owning the business, but with absolutely no money. I hadn't got a rex. And we'd maxed out all our cash flow with the restaurant business. And we sort of had to stand back for a year and go, well, this is great. I own it now, but actually I can't do anything because I have no money. And at the time, we had a long lease on Henry Street. The rents were going crazy in Henry Street in 1990. We had a fixed rent of, I remember, 25,000, when the market rent at the time was about 250,000. And we had another, I think, 27 years to go at the lower rent. So we went to the family who owned the Henry Street property, and we bought it in. It had been handed down through, I think, four generations. So there were 16 different owners from the far corners of the world. And we tracked them all down, bought in their shares, and eventually bought the freehold of Henry Street, and then put the rent up to 200, the market rent 250,000, and then sold the freehold to one of the big insurance companies for about 2.5 million. And that then suddenly put money in the till again, and we could go again. It was a big cost in terms of going from 25 to 250. It gave us cash to really start thinking about what we could do again.
Your plan at that stage, was it buy the business, pay down the debt, and take a salary for being the CEO, and just and maybe continue to grow with, you know, the restaurants and everything else that you've been doing up to that point?
I bought the 80% shareholding. So then I sort of suddenly having been on a sort of whirlwind of 20 years of, you know, developing businesses and shops and restaurants, suddenly I was going, God, this is great, but now I actually can't do anything. And there's so many more opportunities. There was lots of restaurants to be opened. We just had to get cash in. So it was either raise equity. I couldn't borrow more because I already had substantial borrowings in that business. So it was either go to outside capital, which I didn't want to do, or sell the Henry Street. So the Henry Street gave us the cash to get going again. And then we opened more restaurants around Ireland. Around that time, Cuisine de France appeared on the scene. They really started hitting us hard on the Parbake area and the supermarket area. We realized that the market had changed and we'd been caught napping a little bit. We had sort of regarded it as a fad at the beginning because we thought it wouldn't last. And then not only did it last, but it became an incredibly strong business. Mm. So we had to go and we had to find a way of getting into the Parbake business. And through business expansion schemes, the bank and government grants, we managed to raise the $3 million to build a Parbake plant. And we started to compete in the Parbake market. You're starting into what now become a mature market. Cuisine de France had really done a magnificent job all across Ireland with their clients, their product, their business. And we were coming very late to the party with a new frozen plant. On a fresh truck, the truck can turn over about 10,000 a week in terms of it's going twice a day from the bakery to the stores. But because it's fresh, it can only go from 7 in the morning till midday. Mm-hmm. And then your truck is lying there all day from midday to the holiday day. Ditto your plant. In the frozen business, the trucks can run 24/7. They were going around to super values at 12 o'clock at night and putting in product at them for the next day. So we're turning over 35,000 a week per truck. We were doing 10. We hadn't spotted that. That was a big mistake on our part. We didn't have a fleet of frozen trucks to go into. Ditto the plant, although it's $3 million investment, it can run 24/7. In fact, we ended up running that plant 24/7. We only ever stopped it on Christmas Day, on Boxing Day, and one 12-hour session once a week for service. So we learned the hard way, and we ran up some substantial losses in the Parbake. But eventually we got there. And we got recognition in the market and we worked closely with Cuisine de France rather than against them. And that was a very good story in the end. It worked out very, very well.
How did you work with Cuisine de France? How did that come about?
They had a situation where they were importing all of the product from France and we were making it in Ireland a lot cheaper. So rather than compete with them, we worked with them to supply them as well as keeping our own supermarket business going. So we were supplying the frozen through Cuisine de France and we were supplying the fresh to our own business. And it actually worked out very, you know, you look at it now, it seems so, it's so common sense at the time to do it, but you have to earn the hard yards, first of all, and learn the lessons before you come to a sensible deal.
From a personal standpoint, can you remember thinking, was the business ever in trouble at that stage, or did you kind of think at any stage that you might have made a mistake buying into it and then maybe being asleep at the wheel as such to and coming across these problems? Were you ever in that much of a crisis at that stage?
We were because we raised money in 1990, we then bought the old Gatto factory out in Finglas in 1992. And that was a big chunk of money, you know, to swap out of the old bakery and Store Street and go out there. And then we started Parbake. Granted, the IDA and the bank and the BS investors were very good to us and funded that. So it was all the time you had lots of ideas about growing the business. You just didn't have enough cash to get them going. And then once you started the business, you assumed X, Y, and Z would happen. And of course, A and B and C happened and X, Y, and Z didn't happen. So there's a learning curve. But we managed to get through it. There was no crisis point. We were always hungry for cash and burning cash. But we had a very good restaurant business and we still had a very good bakery business. So if you take the three strands of the business, there was the fresh bakery, the restaurants, and the Parbake, right through the 90s and 2000s, two of the three were always performing well.
If you hadn't gone in to compete with Cuisine de France in frozen, do you think that the company still would have been able to survive, maybe on a smaller scale, just using the restaurants and the bakeries?
No, the fresh bakery business, you could see the coming of the in-store bakery and the you know, where we had the frozen dough model in 1970, it was quite cumbersome. You had to make it, freeze it, then bring it out the store. So in-store, from the time you took it out of the freezer to the time it came out of the oven baked was about 4 hours. And that was the great thing about the Parabake, was they could go into the freezer, take out a Parabake baguette and have it on the shelf in 15 minutes. Mm-hmm. And that was a huge win. Again, something we hadn't spotted at the time was in terms of your wastage factor. You know, if you're baking at 5 o'clock in the evening, you're probably going to waste 50% of it. They could literally bake 2, 3, 4, or 10 baguettes at 5 o'clock in the evening and do it on demand. So there, the model of the Parabake was so much more efficient than the fresh business that inevitably you could see over a period of time, the fresh business wasn't going to survive.
Had you not seen it, or I know you said you thought it might have been a fad when you first came across it, or when Cuisine de France were gaining a foothold, had you just not seen it, or did you just decide that it wasn't worth investing in?
Our focus was the cafes. They were doing very well, and we were trying to open those as many as we could. And the bakery business had sort of been there forever. And there wasn't a big change to that. So we didn't really give it enough respect at the beginning. Like all startups, you kind of look at it and go, oh, that won't last enough. Boy, were we wrong. So we just, I don't think, gave it enough respect at the beginning. And then we decided, okay, well, we have to do something. So we went into the business. In the end, it was the right decision. We traded very well in Parabake from 95 until 2009 for 14 years. And eventually sold the business back to Cuisine de France. That story, you know, from the beginning to end was a good story with a couple of very dodgy years at the beginning.
So how did DCC get involved?
So, yeah, so we got Parabake going. I kind of realized in 1997 that I'd been working for 27 years straight. I had Parabake, restaurants, and the bakery all going pretty well. I just realized that I still had a mortgage on my house and I had no money, and I had, you know, it was about time to maybe make a change in my life, do something. I also realized that I'd become the absolutely typical owner driver. Nobody can do anything except me, sort of, you know, I had built a great team, but they were my team and I was driving the whole bus, and we'd gotten it up to a substantial size business. And I was kind of exhausted. And I suddenly realized, you know, I can't do this for the next 20 years. I've got to make a change. And I went to a couple of people. We talked to some investors firstly, but they all wanted, you know, the typical venture capital return on IIRs and clawbacks if you didn't hit certain targets. And it was all very aggressive stuff that I didn't really like. We talked to Bewley's for a while. Paddy Campbell had then bought Bewley's and made a huge success out of it. It was a fantastic business. You know, the cultures of the two companies was very different, and we didn't know anything about contract catering at that time. People knew we were in the market looking for a partnership. We didn't want to sell, but we wanted a strategic partner. I knew I was not a professional manager by any shape or form, and I needed to bring in somebody who could actually put some real structure into the business. Even from a family perspective, at that stage, my father had died. And just, you know, to bring about, I'd seen so many family businesses struggling with the next generation. I didn't want to be that situation for my family. So fortunately, DCC for us had been the underbidders on Cuisine de France, and had also got a very successful coffee business in Robert Roberts. So they were the joining up between the Parabake, which they at that time owned Allied Foods, which was the largest frozen food distributor in Ireland at the time. So the marriage of Parabake and Allied Foods and restaurants and Robert Roberts, that was great. We spent a year doing the deal. Everybody I met in DCC was just so professional, so unlike anything I'd ever come across in my own business. You know, there were people who were far better and far more intelligent than I was, who didn't have that over family sort of feel about a business. So they saw a bit, they bought and sold businesses, you know, and invested in businesses, and they were real professional investors. We went to them and they wanted a 60-40 deal, and we said no, either 50 or 100. And we talked about that for about a year, I'd say, and we eventually got together, and over a retracted due diligence process, which again in itself was brilliant, because looking at the business from their side. It was the first time I'd actually done due diligence, seeing their due diligence report and all the flaws I was making in the business that they had highlighted. They saw opportunities that I didn't. So it was just such a learning curve. Eventually we did the deal. We did the 50% deal. There was no golden share. There's no everything's by agreement. And without a doubt, it's been the best deal I've ever done in my life. Almost like the Brexit negotiations, you know, eventually, you know, you're going to be in bed together for the next X number of years. You have to hammer something out that is acceptable to all the parties. And that has been the way with them. They're just really, really professional company.
And what is it about the partnership that has made it such a good deal for you over the last 20 years?
I suppose several things. First of all, I got money off the table. So age 38, I had money in the bank. I'd never had money in the bank ever. I didn't actually know what to do with it. I'd never, you know, people were still saying, what are you going to do? And I went, I have no idea. I've never had this situation. And I wanted to secure the family home, the kids' education, just, you know, to be able to take the foot off the pedal a little bit and not every day gamble everything. So that was for me, was a huge mindset of actually saying, okay, everything is now paid for that I own and we can have a nice lifestyle. But for the business, they introduced so many financial controls and financial routines on the business that I just would never have thought of it, from IT to, well, particularly cash flow. I had no idea what cash flow was. And I always remember asking Jim how he valued the business. And he said, well, I look at the bank balance on the 1st of January and I look at the bank balance on the 31st of December, and that's how I value a business. You know? And everybody else was talking about multiples and EBITDA and EBITDA and EBITDA. You know, Jim was such a simple analytical genius, and he liked our business because it was cash positive. So that was a joining of the minds. But then they taught us how to use our cash better. They taught us how to manage our cash better. And then I sat on the board of DCC Foods. So I had, and they sat, and we had four DCC directors on our board, and I sat on the DCC Foods board. So there was a tremendous exchange of knowledge across the food business that helped us in our business and help them understand our business and me to understand their business. So it really was a marriage, you know, without a doubt, the best deal I've ever done. And we put in a clause in the contract that I can go after 5 years. It was always assumed I would go after 5 years, and 20 years later, I'm still there. So, you know, we're still all happy. We're still all enjoying the fruits of the partnership.
And did you stay on as the CEO of the business even after
yes,
the sale?
That was the deal. They had the chair and I had the CEO role, and their auditor took over the audit and our lawyer took over the legal. So it was a 50-50 agreed deal, basically.
So you had said you were kind of looking for some more kind of professional management in the business. Did DCC bring that to the table as well?
Very much so. They kind of left us alone. Our management team didn't change, but they sat on the board. I was fortunate. We had four DCC Foods directors sitting on our board who had tremendous knowledge of the food and the coffee business. And they wanted to learn the restaurant and the catering side of the business. And they wanted to learn the power bake side of the business. And we wanted to learn, you know, how to manage really professionally and really well. So it was a win-win for both of us. So that went on into the early 2000s. And we opened our last Cafe Colmore in Swords in 2001. That's when the rent started to going crazy. So that was really how we started KSG. We sat down and said, okay, so we've now got this successful restaurant company. We don't want to open any more restaurants. We don't want to sign more leases. Where can we go? And really, as part of that board discussion, we came up with the idea of the contract catering business. And again, the bigger thinking DCC guys were saying, well, you know, it's a global market. You know, if you have 15 restaurants in Ireland, but probably unlikely to sell them to anybody except an Irish person. Whereas the contract catering business, you have the top five global companies who are FTSE 100 and listed in America and FTSE in France. And it's a global business. So you're now entering a business which has a much bigger reach and a much bigger list of buyers globally if you ever wanted to sell it, which I'd never thought of a business like that. My, you know, because you start at the coalface and you're just head down, you never, only you're thinking about the business making money and the business making cash. You never actually get your head above the ground to start thinking strategically or even where the business might go. So it was the first time we had a kind of a strategy, if you like, to go to a different model and a different business. And that's how we got into it. And again, I would credit DCC board very much with that, in encouraging that strategy.
So did you go into other markets then outside of Ireland with the contract catering business?
We have one site in the UK. That's our only contract in the UK, in London at the moment. We'd like to get into the UK. And we certainly have been looking hard at units over there. Not looking very hard for the last 9 months, and probably won't until this thing comes and goes. But we would certainly like to be overseas, definitely.
Becoming a partner with DCC, would that have made you a public company? Certainly would have had restrictions or things that you would have had to meet in terms of reporting and so on and so forth.
You know, as part of our agreement to do the deal, we had signed up to all of the required reporting from DCC. We wanted it. We wanted to get to that level. I mean, I think they were then known as the fastest reporting PLC in the Irish stock market. They reported their full accounts 6 weeks after the end of the year. And that was very much the standard they would have set for us, and very much the standard we wanted. So there's 12 periods. There's it's 5-5-4-4, 5-4-4 every quarter, and everything is reviewed on a quarterly basis and submitted. And we had that culture anyway. We would have always had weekly P&L meetings with our team long before, way back. One of the hangovers, I suppose, of starting with, again, such a tight cash position. I was always very keen. I used to say to the guys, it's much more important to know how much you're losing than it is to know how much you're making. I did try and get that into every unit that we had, you know, that we had. Our goal was to any units that were underperforming or even loss-making was to throw all the resources we had in the business at those units to turn them around and get them into a profitable making. You don't worry so much about the units making money as you do about the units not making money. But they would have had the same culture. So it would, again, it was very much a meeting of minds, what they were offering / signing up to in the shareholders agreement. I was totally and utterly wanted that.
It seems by starting to do business, say, with Marks and Spencer's and then with McDonald's and then the partnership with DCC, that you were constantly looking for ways to improve the business and ways to kind of learn from other businesses who might have been further along or larger or whatever it might have been. Where did that come from? Where did that understanding that partnering with these businesses would have made you better?
I think it's just a part of my DNA. I at school, I said I wasn't great at school because I was always just thinking about something else. My Uncle John used to say I had a butterfly mind. I think today you'd be told it was ADD or something, one of those things. So I was always lying awake in bed at night thinking, what's the next thing? Where are we going? You know, I always trying to think of looking forward. And today I'm still the same. I'm all the time looking 5-10 years ahead. What's the next gig? What's the next? And it doesn't have to be money or shares. You know, it can be trends, it can be fashion, it can be music, it can be science, it can be medicine, it can be, you know, just all the time thinking, when is the next thing that's going to catch my attention come along? So, yeah, I probably have a love of learning, but not academic learning. I don't read papers. I don't film. My desk is, there's about 2 pieces of paper on my desk. Everything is either up here or it's in my phone. Sadly, as I get older, it's more in my phone than up here.
So I suppose throughout your career as working as the CEO of the business, owning the business, you must have found at some stage that you had some weaknesses that you would have had to put other people in place to deal with, or maybe you improved on those things. Did you have an understanding of what those were?
Yeah, you know, we all, I probably, if I was to fault myself with anything, I said, I have no patience. You know, I want everything now. Mm-hmm. And I'm very, again, the butterfly mind kicks in if something is taking too long, or, you know, I'm not a process guy. I'm not a good manager, being honest, because I, you know, I see the guys running the business now and they're just so good at what they do. And they have the patience and they have the time and they do it right and they don't cut corners and everything. I was always that, you know, let's do it now sort of guy, which I think probably was a very bad example to set to a lot of the people in the business. But I always tried to employ people who were the exact opposite. And even myself and DCC would probably be exact opposites in a partnership. So I recognize that and try to employ or bring to the table people who will make up for that weakness in my character. When it was a family business, I think all owners of family business, particularly second or third generation, get far too paternalistic about employees and people who work with them, to the point that you become their mother and their father. And we all go to the church of whatever the company name is. I think the real thing I learned from dealing with a PLC is that there's a time and a place, and everybody knows what the strategy is, and everybody knows what the focus is, and everybody knows what they've got to do. So it's much more structured and much more organized. And there isn't the same paternalistic. Obviously, everybody, particularly a startup PLC, everybody will aspire to the CEO and work with them. But it's just a very different culture, and one that I always wanted to bring into the business. I didn't ever like the family culture that I had grown up with and seen the damage that it can cause in families, not just our business, but so many family businesses in Ireland that you've seen over the last 30 years have gone into the most awful state with second and third generations. I never wanted that to happen.
Throughout that time as well, did you have anyone in particular that you took advice from? Maybe people that were in the generation above you in terms of the family business? Or was it mostly the businesses you partnered with as suppliers and then DCC?
I think the biggest education and the biggest source of knowledge outside of the business was an organization called Young Presence Organization, YPO. Cormac McAlinden from Lithographic Universal, a very, very forward and progressive company in Bray, approached me with a group of guys to start up Young Presence Organization. And I was kind of very dismissive of it at the time. But we ended up in a room in Rowley's restaurant, 10 of us, and all of the guys were either chief executives or family businesses. And the whole ethos of YPO is better presidents through ideas, exchange, and education. And you meet in what's known as a forum, and you all sign up to meeting once a month. Everything that's said in the room stays in the room. So you can talk about, and we all realize that being a chief executive is a very lonely spot, in that if the business is going great, that's fine. But if the business is going badly, if you have problems, be they financial, business, problems with your chairman, problems with your family shareholders, problems with whatever, that you've nowhere to go. And so to be able once a month to go to this group of very talented people, much more talented than I was, and be able to get advice and be able to listen to what they had to say, and also listen to and share their good stories and bad stories, was absolutely life-changing. I always look back on my education in YPO as by far the best education I've ever had. And the range of mentors that I've come across in that time with that organization, no matter what happened, I was able to pick up the phone and say, guys, I want to meet. I've got a problem here and there. So that was just an amazing outlet to have. It still is. I'm still a member of YPO. I'm not very active now. I'm now in their older league. They call it the gold. But it was probably the best education and the best forum that I had. So I didn't really have any mentors in business outside of that, no.
Can you remember any problems that you had over time that you would have brought maybe to the forum at YPO as something that would have been solved by the group?
But my particular one is, I remember the time sterling and the Irish pound broke parity. I remember the sterling, the Irish pound crash. And I had just bought my old man out, or 80% rather. And I owed the bank 4.5 million Irish pounds. And the week before the exchange was broken, interest rates had hit 37%. And my finance director came into me and he said, at the current rate, we are bust in 26 days. You know, that's that. And it was a Monday that we were going to do YPO meeting. And I went in and I mean, my head was down. I was going, what have I done? I mean, like, you know, I've run this business for 20 years and suddenly I want to go and buy it. And this happens, like, I'm going to lose everything. The whole thing's down the toilet. So we go to the meeting and everybody has exactly the same problem. With a large PLCs, family businesses, there was two bankers out there, and they all said the same thing. Look, this can't happen because the whole country's going bust. So they have to break the link sometime this week or everybody's gone. And I just remember going home to bed that night thinking, that's the first time in like a month that I've actually been able to sleep, because just that camaraderie and having people in the same situation, but having maybe a bit more experience, maybe a bit more gray hair around the table, was such a huge benefit.
What involvement do you have in the business now?
I'm a main board director, our former finance director and then COO and now chief executive was Michael Gleeson, who's been with the company for 14 years, a fantastic, fantastic guy. Again, came from a PLC background before he came to us. So he understands the whole makeup, really fine financial guy, but very good in the services business, great integrity, liked by the staff and the clients enormously. So he's running it now and doing a super job. Even despite COVID-19, he has really managed that storm brilliantly. And I think probably better than I would have. So I sit in on the manager meeting. I attend the board meetings and I will talk to Michael or the team every so often. I used to love before COVID-19, just going out to the office and getting a cup of coffee and going around and sitting on people's desks. And I always refer to it as listening to the noise. I think it's so important. And again, I don't pick up things from paper. I can't read a report and understand it. So to me, just to march around the office with a cup of coffee and knock on the desk and say, have you got 5 minutes? And just listen to what the HR guy or the purchasing manager or the finance manager or the accounts or the credit or our operations people. You learn so much from just listening and chatting with them. And I love that part. I really missed that in COVID-19. But I don't get involved. I don't impart any knowledge I have. I'm happy to impart it, but I don't get involved in any decision making at all.
Have you found it hard to step away since moving more into a non-executive role rather than the CEO role?
No, surprisingly, I resisted it right up until I was 66, thinking I'd never retire. You say to the kids, I'm going to die at my desk. And since I've actually gone cold turkey, I think the first 6 months was hard. But yeah, the last 2.5 years have been fantastic. I've taken up cycling, traveling more, enjoying life more than I ever thought I would.
So throughout your career, I'm sure you were very busy with the business and everything else. You have a family and you've managed to manage family time as at the same time run a very successful business. How did you do that?
Well, I think my wife did it more than I did it. It was, she's been amazing all along. I was lucky when we got married, she ran her own business for many, many years. So she understood the sacrifices that one'd make and not being there at some of the important times that you're supposed to be there, coming in at 12 o'clock at night or even at 3 o'clock in the morning or whatever I was doing. But she was very understanding and very helpful. And that really, I think, provides you the base to work hard and to actually get involved in the business. I think a great home life is really a foundation of working hard and being successful in business. It's very hard if you are really giving everything to your business and you're not appreciated at home. So I just, I think I give her the credit for that one rather than myself, Connor.
And you were probably lucky in the sense that you were running the business or you were at least in the business from a very young age. So I suppose by the time you met your wife, she knew what she was signing up for in a sense.
Yeah, that's true. And being an entrepreneur herself, I think she completely understood it. So it was fortunate, yeah.
Brian Hogan, I think that's a very good place to finish. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast.
Great pleasure and lovely to meet you, Connor.
Yeah, likewise, Brian.
This podcast is produced by JetBooks, an online bookkeeping service dedicated to giving you real-time financial information at the click of a button. Our team of qualified accountants leverage the power of cloud technology to automate your manual processes and cut the cost of your finance function in half. Head to jetbooks.ie/resources to pick up our free step-by-step guide on how to automate your bookkeeping. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others to find the show. I'm your host, Connor Carney. Thanks for listening.